Chapter 30. I drive home in a stupor. The day Robin helped me, she had a backpack and we went into the student union together. We were just two college students hanging out in the cafe. Except, Robin Bailey wasn't on campus to go to classes. I realized I didn't actually see her walk into any classroom. So why was she there? As I closed the front door behind me, a bad thought pops into my head. Why a girl who was addicted to pills and meth might be carrying a backpack around campus. Shame washes over me. I'm no better than those assholes talking trash about Robin at the hockey game the minute they found out she overdosed. Two girls possibly dealing meth, both dead. Should I tell Jamie and Ron what I learned about Robin? And about my suspicion that she was dealing meth or pills on campus? Or do I wait until I'm certain? Come on, Donis, focus. Something has to make sense. I hear the crinkle of plastic in my backpack. The mushrooms. I sit at my desk and research the three samples I collected today. Cross-reference them with photographs in the three different field guide books and the mushroom identification websites I've come to know as well as their creators and web administrators. The first two are confirmed to be well-documented varieties. The final one is black, with bumpy white warts on its irregularly shaped cap. It stinks too much to take it from the bag. Once I get a closer look, I realize the white spots aren't warts. They're minuscule white fungi growing from the dark mushroom, like the mushroom equivalent of an anglerfish, completely dependent on its host for nutrients. This could be it. A new variety. Anticipation builds. In the next instant, I crash and burn. It's in the database. Asterophora parasitica. A rare variety, but not an undiscovered one. I throw the sandwich bag of anglerfish mushrooms across my bedroom. All that time wasted on this wild goose chase. Not a waste, Donis. Ruling things out is part of the process, Uncle David reminds me. Frustration churns inside me like magma. I must have missed something. Somewhere. Shit. Triple, quadruple, infinity, shit. The scent of freshly baked cookies wafts under my bedroom door, along with Harry's paw reaching through the gap for the bag. I jump up to grab it before she can hook the plastic with her claws. I need to be more careful. The mushrooms could have been toxic to Harry. My rash actions could be dangerous to others. I join Mom in the kitchen, take a warm macadamia nut cookie from the parchment paper on the counter. It melts in my mouth. The sweetness jolts my molars. Okay, the mushrooms didn't reveal any answers, so it's on to the next step of my plan. Mom, did Uncle David keep journals anywhere else besides his home office? She gives me a quizzical look, before her eyes shift upward to tap into her mental data files. He started with a diary, you know, when we were kids, always writing down what he did that day. She smiles at the memory. He kept them in our treehouse. Nothing like what the twins have, but it was perfect for us. We'd read and play cards. He'd write in his diary and leave it in an opening where a squirrel once made a home. She pulls a cookie apart and eats one half, sighing contentedly. They tore it down when we were teens to make room for the gazebo. The tree, too. She shakes her head. Why do you ask? I've just been missing him and thinking about him, especially those last weeks, I say carefully. Just wondered what he was preoccupied with. My mother tenses. Grand Mary and I didn't believe her. I put my arm around Mom and wish I could give her more than a silent apology. But I don't know what I can say without revealing too much. My reticence is a lie by omission, one that's hurting my mother. When the investigation is over, I can tell Mom the truth. She was right all along. He was spending all of his time at school, as far as I knew, she says. You would have seen him more than me those last weeks. I remember him organizing his chem storage room, I tell her. He didn't bother with anything so easy as alphabetical order. I smile and hug her more closely. He had to put them in reverse order of their group number and then in descending order of their atomic mass. Everyone who looked at his storage room would see random labeled jars. Only people who knew the periodic table frontward and backward would see the order. Sometimes he'd tell an AP Chem student, "Go get a metalloid with an atomic number that's second smallest in their group." We'd wait for them to return with the jar labeled silicon. It seemed like just a nerdy Uncle David quirk. Only now do I realize that maybe he did it to tell if anyone had moved things around. Ron must have inspected the chem storage room and dusted for fingerprints. There'd be students' prints, nothing to narrow down anyone stealing chemicals. Plus, Uncle David didn't have anything toxic or unstable. Just an inventory of the chemicals he might want to use for lessons or his own research. Okay, Mom didn't provide an instant answer. I'll regroup and try again later. For now, I move on to the next task in my sequenced list. Hey, Mom. Did you think it was okay for Grand Mary to include Grandpa Lorenzo's office furniture when she sold the building to Mrs. Edwards? Where did that come from? She asks, taken aback. I shrug. Just wondered if she asked you first. No, Mom says curtly. She did not. Change is so hard for my mother. Was she always like this? Even in the before, a part of her was stuck in 1985, the accident on Sugar Island when she told my dad about me. I wonder if Grand Mary remembered to tell Mrs. Edwards about the desk drawer that stuck when it rained and about the key hook at the back of the top drawer, I say. I'm sure she went over every detail when she turned it over to Helene and Grant. David would hate to admit it, but he got that quality from our mother. Even down to the spare key for the desk? I keep my voice as casual as possible. Oh, I'm certain. Your grandmother was very thorough. My heart sinks again. No instant answer. And an even more distressing thought. Mom just used the past tense when speaking about Grand Mary. A tiny subconscious slip. Change comes even when we consciously tried to avoid it. On Monday, Auntie and I have an appointment at the hospital lab. She made the appointment there instead of at Tribal Health, where she is the director, so no one can claim she used her position to influence the outcome. Would someone really do that? I ask. I don't put it past anyone, she says wearily. The results of the blood test, showing a familial relationship between my paternal aunt and me, will be sent directly to the tribal enrollment clerk to be added to my membership application file. I drive from the hospital to the tribal enrollment office to drop off my application and supporting affidavits. Stormy is there, asking the receptionist if his tribal ID will be enough to get him across the international bridge. He can't find his passport. You know how CBP is with tribal members, she tells him. It's hit or miss if them officers ever heard about the Jay Treaty. The Jay Treaty is supposed to let Anishinaabes cross the border freely, but people always complain that CBP asks for different documentation every time. Sometimes they'll wave you through. Other times they require an ID, a birth certificate, and a statement on official letterhead listing your blood quantum and your parents, too. When he turns around, he looks so dejected. Sometimes Stormy is such an asshole, and other times you just feel bad for the hand he got dealt. What's across the bridge? I ask. Eh, he says, trying for nonchalance. Greyhounds hockey tonight. Coach Albert's got us tickets to go, the whole team, going to the mall first and dinner. Where do you think your passport could be? He shrugs. Probably at my ma's. I look around. Is Levi waiting for you? No, I walked here after fifth period. It's really windy and there's a storm gaining power over Lake Superior. Come on, I say. I'll take you to the island and you can look for it. Really? There's just enough hope in his voice that I almost forget about the times he's a jerk. On the ferry, Stormy takes Seima from the pouch I keep in a cup holder and makes a silent offering to the river. I'm initially surprised by his knowing the old ways, but on second thought, his parents attend ceremonies when they're doing well. Clear eyes and open hearts. as Auntie says when she means drug and alcohol free. The closer we get to his mom's house on the original res, the less confident he is. Yeah, probably won't find it. It doesn't really matter, he says. I believe in you, Stormy, I say, keeping my voice light so he knows I'm just teasing. He laughs and goes inside. I wait in the Jeep until his mom opens her front door and waves for me to come in. Shauna Noden must have clear eyes and an open heart these days. She offers me coffee, and even though I don't drink it often, I accept her hospitality. Her small house is spotlessly clean. There are school pictures of Stormy taped on the wall. They're the only decoration, except for one poster advertising last year's Anishinaabe Moin conference. The print image is of an institutional-looking boarding school in the background. In the foreground, there are teepees set up just beyond the fence surrounding the school. I've never seen that old photograph before, but there is something defiant and reassuring about it. The proof that even when their children were taken away, there were some parents who followed them. Maybe they drummed and sang and prayed while their children were forbidden from speaking the language on the other side of the fence. Maybe, just maybe, a kid heard the familiar songs in the distance. Maybe even smelled the smudge carrying their parents' prayers to Creator. There's a pot of soup or something simmering on the stove. It smells good. I'm glad for Shauna. I'm even more glad for Stormy. My shoulders tense when Stormy's dad comes down the hallway. A lot of the Nodens think of me as more Zaganash than Nish. My childhood nickname of Ghost was started by a Noden boy a year older than me. Stormy's dad sits across from me and lights a cigarette, blows a puff of smoke my way, gives a cold, silent appraisal of me while Shauna pours him a cup of coffee. Stormy is making a ruckus in his bedroom, slamming dresser drawers and swearing. When the cigarette is nothing but a stub in an ashtray, Stormy's dad speaks. Your grandma hosted those cards and crafts things. Do-gooder shit for the hospital. I give a half nod. Grand Mary and the hospital's volunteer auxiliary. Stormy's dad continues like he's been stewing for years, waiting for me to show up in his living room so he can tell me exactly how he feels about my family. Old rich Zaganash ladies played cards in the center of the room. Then they took a break, walked around the tables where we had our stuff set out for sale. Beadwork, leather, wood carvings. Smoke from the next cigarette puffs my way. Them ladies could have paid 10 times over for everything on our tables, but they still haggled, looking for a deal. His simmering hostility makes me uncomfortable. Down the hallway, it sounds like Stormy is demolishing his bedroom down to the studs. Shauna joins us at the table. She puts a hand on her husband's sleeve and rubs it gently while he continues talking. I went with my grandpa. Your grandma wrinkled her nose at his baskets, at his prices. I don't know what to say in response. All Stormy's dad sees in me is my Zaganash family. Grand Mary loves me, but she did not care much for Indians, even before my dad came along. It's hard to reconcile not liking, even despising, parts of someone you love. Is it possible the heart can expand to hold love as well as all the complicated emotions? Your grandpa's baskets are beautiful, I say, worth more than he ever asked for. He makes a dismissive sound, psh, as he grinds the cigarette butt into an ashtray. Stormy enters with a navy blue passport booklet and a victorious smile. Hey, Ma, he says, you got any money so I can get something to eat with the team? Shauna shakes her head. Just paid October rent. His dad stands up and pulls out a wallet, counts the dollar bills. Stormy and his dad get per cap checks each month, but his dad's is garnished by the county court for some legal trouble and attorney fees. I think Stormy's check is their only income. $9, he says, handing his son everything he's got. Even with the favorable exchange rate, that won't cover more than a hot dog and a pop. Stormy, Macy, and I did our coming of age fast the same time, although I was more than a year older. I heard Stormy's dad drumming and singing every so often, from a tree stand in the distance. just so Stormy would know he was nearby. Me gwich for the coffee, I tell Shauna.
Mukade mushkeke wabo.
Nishan, she says. Black medicine drink. It is good. Aho, I acknowledge. That is all. Stormy and I are silent in the jeep. He stares out the window as I drive to the ferry. The dark storm clouds are visible in the distance. Leaves whip around us. My sequence list calls out to me and I just can't. It doesn't feel appropriate to use this ride to pump Stormy for information about two dead girls who happen to be his cousins. The perfect secret squirrel would stay on task, but I am no longer going by the book. Once we're on the ferry, I finally speak because the silence grows more awkward with each passing minute. Your mom and dad looked good, hey? Psh, Stormy says, sounding exactly like his dad. This week. He makes another offering to the river. After all, it is a new river each time. My phone buzzes with an incoming text. Levi.
Hey, do you got your debit card for Canada?
Me.
Yes.
Levi.
I can't find mine. Can I borrow?
Me.
Yes.
Do a favor, no questions. Sit with Stormy, Mike, Jamie at dinner. Say your treat before they order. Exiting the ferry ramp, we pass the line of cars waiting to board the ferry to the island. In the middle of the convoy is a tribal cop car. Stormy motions at the large figure behind the wheel.
Ghosts of Christmas Past, he says of Officer Kiwaden.
Psh, I ain't afraid of no ghosts, I say, mimicking both his dad and the Ghostbusters movie. Stormy laughs. I drop him off at Chimukwa for the bus to the Greyhounds game. Levi catches me before I drive away. He comes over to get the debit card just as Jamie pulls into the parking lot. My brother greets Jamie with a fist bump. Have fun at the game, I say. And Jamie, don't forget to text if you go anywhere besides the mall and the arena. For fairness. Jamie gives a brief smile before leaning his head through the open window for a kiss. His peck on the cheek is underwhelming. I hide my disappointment beneath an extra cheesy grin. Come on, lover boy, my brother tells Jamie. We're late for the naughty nickel. Levi Firekeeper, you'd better not take him there. I play up my outrage. The guys laugh. Do I want to know? Jamie says. I roll my eyes. Strip club, your coach isn't taking you there, no matter how much Levi pesters him. The sky becomes a dark gray ceiling with a curtain of cold rain whipping sideways across the parking lot. The guys dash to the team bus. I wait until they're safely inside before I drive away through the sideways downpour. Gusts of wind rock the jeep all the way home. I try concentrating on the road as fragmented thoughts lurch back and forth. Duck Island's a bust. Uncomfortable around Stormy's dad. No journal yet. Why uncomfortable? No spare key for that desk. Unflattering story about Grand Mary. When to ask Stormy about his two girl cousins. Entirely plausible for Grand Mary to behave that way. Make sure there's enough money for Levi to pay for dinner. Jamie's peck on the cheek felt blah. Who else has info on Robin? I glance at the time once I'm back home. I need to check the balance in the account. Make sure there's enough to pay for dinner. Levi can be careless with his spending, and who knows what they'll get up to tonight. I look through the Longa Burger basket where Mom puts all the bills and bank statements. My trust account statement is there, along with the one from my savings account in town. Nothing from Canada. That's odd. It isn't until I go through last year's financial documents in the metal filing cabinet in the basement that I find an old statement from the joint account. I run back upstairs and call from the house phone, giving my name, account number, date of birth, and address. I show a different mailing address on the account, the customer service lady says, giving Levi's address. Is there a problem? Do we need to freeze the account? No, I say quickly. That's my brother's address. He's on the account too. He uses it more than I do. I should text Levi to let him know how much is in the account, in case he wants to shop at the mall before or after dinner. What's the current balance? I ask. We usually keep the equivalent of about $400 US in the account.
With the exchange rate, it should be around $500 Canadian. $4,856.77.
Holy.
Did you say 4,000? Yes. A few heartbeats later, she says, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I breathe an enormous sigh of relief. The bank lady continues, I gave you the amount from your August statement. The current balance is $10,856.77.